Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It started in New Orleans as the French game of poke, moved north on Mississippi riverboats into saloons and parlors, smoky dens and Vegas, and into American history and culture. America's affair with poker took hold in the early 19th century, and it's still going stronger now in numbers as it's gone to the web. Gangsters, card sharps, presidents, housewives, college students, they're all in. This hour on point, poker, and the USA, we will hear later this hour from Joe Cotta, who last week became the youngest winner ever of the World Series of Poker main event. But first, joining me from New York is James McManus. He's a best-selling journalist and author who writes about poker for the New York Times and other publications. His new book, Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker, came out last month. He came in fifth in the World Series of Poker in 2000, and his memoir about that experience, Positively Fifth Street, was a Times bestseller. Now he's got the whole history of poker's imprint on American culture. James McManus, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm real happy to be here with you, Tom.
You're making a big case about a game that I have to admit I didn't know where poker came from. It may help us to just get started right there. How did this game get started and move right across the country?
Well, there were a number of vying games that the Europeans were playing since the Renaissance. The English played brag, the Germans played poker, and the French played poque, P-O-Q-U-E, or okay. However they mm-hmm. would pronounce it.
Yeah.
I give the symbolic birthday for – I propose that it's July 4th, 1803, which is when the news of the Louisiana Purchase arrives from Paris in Washington. At that point, the United States doubles in size. New Orleans becomes an English-American city, English-speaking primarily, instead of a French city. And the game of brag, which is a 52-card game – combines with the French 20-card game of poke to become the game that we now call poker north of the Mason-Dixon line.
And it comes right up the Mississippi River on what you call the first floating casinos in American history. And as you follow it on, really right into the heart of the American psyche, and it's a funny thing, you call it a combination of sort of a Puritan mindset at work in the game of poker. You'll have to explain that for our raging opponents of gambling. And, the go-for-broke, all-in gambling mindset. What's the footprint or the handprint you see of poker here, Jim?
Well, the basic mindset of America is a combination of Puritan work ethic, slow accumulation of savings, not taking big risks or any risks at all, certainly not gambling, combined with the big bet cowboys entrepreneurial spirit, risk all or virtually everything that you have in order to try to make your fortune. And those two traits combined with a democratic openness to all players, whereas in Europe it was mostly aristocrats who gambled. In America, everyone was welcome at the table equally. But by playing effectively and getting lucky and playing skillfully, one became more equal because at the end of the night you had most or all of the chips.
You quote the New York Times from 1875 in an editorial saying the national game is not baseball but poker. This is just kind of central. And you give us so many examples, more than I would ever have imagined, as deep as we all know poker is in the cultural fabric. I mean, you've just got it right, left, and center, up to and not least of which is your citing of Barack Obama's sort of a poker game, way back to Springfield, Illinois, and is, you know, how those metaphors frame up people do, what he did. He told his almost brand-new presidential campaign staff back in January 2007, let's put our chips in the middle of the table and see how we do. Talk about straight-up poker metaphor. There it is.
Yeah, there are hundreds of them, such examples in the book. The first chapter opens with the current president, Obama, making his way in the world, not by winning a by risking or winning or losing a large amount of money, but by using poker, the poker table, the ability to spend 7 or 8 hours of an evening elbow to elbow with the people that you have to do business with the rest of the week. The game that he started was called the committee meeting. And Democrats,
this is in Springfield, back when he was a state representative there.
Yeah, yes, he arrives in 1997, and he's kind of an outsider. He's, you know, this tall, skinny guy with a funny name. He's a law professor at the University of Chicago, a writer, not a natural fit for the average Illinois politician. And the way that he helps himself break the ice, along with Terry Link, a fellow freshman senator, is by starting a poker game in the basement of Link's Springfield home.
And pretty soon he's in like Flynn with all the guys there, and they get to know each other. He's a serious player. They have fun. It's beer and cigars and whatever, but it's networking, and it's serious poker.
It's serious in that people are trying to win, but no one is risking serious money.
Okay.
Obama falls squarely in the larger camp of presidents who played, in that they play primarily to relax with their friends, to expand their network of political colleagues. There are two presidents, however, Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower, who shared the 56th Republican ticket, who played for very serious stakes. In Eisenhower's case, he growing up dirt poor in Kansas, he ends up at West Point, can't afford his dress uniform. But more importantly, he falls for a girl named Mamie Dowd, who is a wealthy Denver socialite. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't have the means to court such a girl or such a young woman. Mm-hmm. And he wins the money to buy his dress uniforms and take her out to fancier places, but he actually pays for the engagement ring that he gives her when he proposes, and of course she accepts. Nixon, even more famously, wins $8,000 in 1945 Navy games in the Pacific. And in the mid-40s, that was a whopping sum of money. It comprised 80% of what he needed to successfully run for Congress in 1946.
Essentially financed his first congressional campaign.
Absolutely.
Off Navy poker winnings. It's just incredible. And you go right on through the presidents. We'll look at them and more. But, I mean, sort of to look at the other side in the Obama race, you quote John McCain's father, Admiral John S. McCain, Jr.?
Yes.
Telling his children, and this is a worldview, he's saying life is run by poker players, not the systems analysts. There's a kind of American message. What's he saying with that?
He's saying that if you want to be a mover and shaker in the world, it's better to have a bold strategic vision and be willing to risk a lot by gaining as much information as possible, such as the sort of the sort of behavior that the best poker players need to display, as opposed to a craps player, which John, his son,
turned out to be,
became.
Right.
And that's a game in which you go with your gut instinct, and it's kind of a loud, mindless game in which you can never have a strategic advantage over the house. The more you play craps or blackjack, the more certain it becomes that you will lose. So that poker, a dispassionate, cooler, more cerebral approach to game. Poker is a game that is susceptible to that kind of approach, whereas craps, you can never outthink the process the way poker players can.
We see where you come down in that poker versus craps mindset competition. You're a poker player, but you write about John McCain, the candidate, his selection of Sarah Palin for the vice presidential slot and his unsteady response to the economic crisis, remember last fall, were two of the better examples of a dice-rolling mindset. I'm afraid you're throwing a little poker player prejudice there, are you not, James McManus?
I certainly have a poker playing mindset, and I certainly voted, I don't know about how certain it is, but I did vote for Obama, but I don't think anyone would disagree that craps is a game that is not susceptible to cool, dispassionate, logical decision making, and poker is a game that rewards patience, smart money management and getting your money in based on a broad range of mathematical and psychological information.
You agree with the New York Times that this is the American game? Are you on board with them?
I don't think there's any question that poker is America's national card game. Mm. It's certainly up in the air as to whether it's our national pastime. If you define it in terms of viewership, certainly more people watch football, baseball, or basketball than watch poker.
Although
television audience is roughly the size of hockey's. However, if you think of it in terms of participation, there's not a lot of people who play tackle football or country hardball the games that they watch on TV. But you know, people have estimated 80 to 100 million Americans play some poker during the year.
And for that matter, the idea of a television audience at all with poker is kind of amazing when you think about it. There's a lot in this book we're going to really dig in. James McManus is with us. His new book is Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Now this girl says I'm in the king, baby, and you is the queen. Since I am the king, baby, and you is the queen. Let's us put our heads together. Who fair brown, then we can make our money green.
We're talking this hour about poker and its deep history in American history, from riverboat gamblers to the White House, and right beyond, James McManus is with us. He's author of the new book, Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He was in the World Series of Poker himself in 2000, came in fifth. Not too bad. Wrote about that in Positively Fifth Street. We will hear before this hour is over from Joe Catta, who was 21 last week when he won the $8.5 million pot in the World Series of Poker main event. His nickname, The Kid, there's another famous kid in American, in at least Hollywood poker history, The Cincinnati Kid. 1965, the movie told the story of Eric Stoner, a young Depression-era poker player, played in the film by Steve McQueen. His quest to dominate the game, he eventually challenges Lancey the Man, Howard, an older player. And here's the climactic final poker hand between the two. Everyone, including the female dealer, is rooting for the kid.
That's $5,000 you owe me, kid.
You still playing, kid?
No, I'm through.
You raise some tens on a lousy three flush.
Gets down to what it's all about, doesn't it? Making the wrong move at the right time.
It all sounds deep there in The Cincinnati Kid. James McManus is with us from New York, and we've got a lot of callers, James. John in Virginia Beach, Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been playing poker for, I guess, 52 years now. I started playing when I was 10 and my brother was 8, and I played all sorts of games and all the stupid games kids play and everything, but I have to agree with the earlier points that poker is a game for really smart people. Robert Heinlein, science fiction writer, once wrote that he earned money during college by teaching probability and statistics to optimists. And that's certainly true. The best poker I ever played, I was a naval officer and an operations analyst, and I used to go travel around conducting exercise, traveled with a troop of other operations analysts, and the game that we played was Sunshine Poker. All cards were up on the table. So what determined who won was the guy who had the best grasp of probability and statistics and could calculate the odds. And like I say, when you play poker that way, it's a game for smart people.
John, do you see it as James McManus does, as somehow near the core of the American character, something about poker?
Maybe a bit hard saying it's near the core of American character, but it certainly rewards things that if you study a subject and you're a master of a subject, you should reap some rewards, and you can certainly do that in poker.
Yeah. John, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it very much. Jim, there's the 52 years of experience speaking to, you know, what it takes to do it well. And you can hear in John's perspective a real respect for this game.
Yeah, and I think he's right, especially if we remember the fact that money is the language of poker. One of the senses in which it is the most American game is that we're the first free market democracy. The capitalist system goes hand in hand with poker values. As Walter Matthau famously put it, poker exemplifies the worst aspects of capitalism, which have made our country so great. You know, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that people that it's a zero-sum game and some people get fabulously wealthy and other people go broke is morally not terribly palatable, but it is the fact of life in the capitalist system, and it's the system that we have lived and died for since the founding of the country.
Unfold its spread for us a little bit. Gambling wasn't new. George Washington, you write, famously loved to play cards and gamble all the way back in his day. Andrew Jackson, one of the most famous gamblers in the country, but poker didn't really take off until after their time. As it headed up the Mississippi from New Orleans, who played it? How did it spread? Did the character of poker change as it spread?
Well, Washington and Jackson were both too old. Their mm-hmm. heydays were over. Washington was dead, I think, by 1799.
Right.
And the poker doesn't really arrive until the first decade or so of the 19th century. By this point, it's being plated by rivermen, wealthy Southerners. You know, the South's economy was booming in the decades before the Civil War. There were a lot of people with huge amounts of disposable income from the plantation and slave trading systems. So it was primarily gamblers who sought an advantage that was calculable. It was different from traditional gambling, in which the luck factor was much larger. In poker, there is a sizable luck factor, but the ability to crunch information about numbers, odds, the amount of money that you have to call to remain in a pot, all of these things can be quickly put together in a poker player's mind in order to make a sound decision that is usually profitable in the long run.
You're not shy about saying that in its early manifestations on the riverboat scene, someone called it the cheater's game, and there was plenty of that.
There's no question that the majority of games in the early years and up until the present are fair, square games played by honest people. But in the 19th century, the larger the game was, the more likely it was that cheaters were involved, because the technology was, by our standards, very rudimentary. People would wear mirrored rings so that as they were dealing the cards, they could see what the whole cards were of their opponents. As in The Sting, we saw Robert Shaw set up a cold deck for Paul Newman. Mm. Robert Shaw was going to get four nines, but Paul Newman and his cronies slip in a double cold deck in which Robert Shaw gets the four nines he was expecting, but Paul Newman, when they've got all of their money in the pot, Paul Newman turns over and says, four jacks, you owe me 15 grand, pal. By those means, that was the main artistry of poker. Today's poker masters, poker artists, win their money with mathematical skill, logic, the ability to read their opponents effectively, and by getting lucky. In the first 150 years or so, the game was dominated, and the highest stakes games were dominated by cheaters.
You're really interesting as you describe how quickly in the 19th century the language of poker became a kind of metaphorical language for the country. Bluff and raise and ante and double down and on and on and on. We began to communicate with each other in this country through sort of poker metaphors and poker circumstances. You describe even Abe Lincoln telling a kind of poker morality play of some kind, using it mm-hmm. to explain some of his moves in the Civil War to American citizens. What was that story?
It was called the Trent Affair, and two Confederate envoys were intercepted by a Yankee schooner that was intercepted a British ship with two Southern ambassadors on it. And the British, which was still the most powerful military and navy in the world, said, you must return those ambassadors and the ship. And Lincoln said that he would, he said, one war at a time. But they said, you also must apologize. And he said, well, that reminds me of a situation that occurred out west. And out west, what he was meant by that was Ohio and Illinois. He said two roughs were playing poker for high stakes when one of them suddenly pinned the hand of the other to the table with a Bowie knife. And he said, if you're not holding the ace of spades under your hand, I'll apologize.
What's interesting, I mean, it's a great
folksy
story.
Way, right. Folksy way of saying, I'm not going to apologize. And he was counting on the American love affair with poker. He was counting on the public's ability to understand the nature of poker and poker cheating in order to get, rally the people to his decision to return the ambassadors but not to apologize to Queen Victoria.
But it's just interesting that in 1861 already the game was widespread enough that he felt this is something, this is the folksy message, this is what people will understand and relate to. And that political and much more broad use of poker rolls right on the Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, you see the language continuing there.
And even today, I mean, the expression that we would use to describe a wartime situation during the Civil War, or today with nuclear, trying to figure out which countries have nuclear weapons, whether they would use them, whether they wouldn't, you cannot read an article about Iran's nuclear capabilities or North Korea's without the word bluff appearing in it. People understand that at its very core, a military situation with the genuine weapons of mass destruction always involves bluffing and the ability to read bluffs effectively.
There's also a sense of what Americans see as fairness economically emerging. I don't know if it's a stretch or not, but you've got Teddy Roosevelt and his fair deal that he talked about a century ago.
Square deal, excuse me.
Coming out, as you read it anyway, from the world of dealing cards and poker.
He was not in love with poker, but he did make his way up the Republican Party ranks very rapidly. And one means that he did it was by playing poker with the bosses of the New York State Republican Party. And when it came time to name his signature social program, he chose a term that he knew the American public understood. And this was at the time when the transition from cheating games to honest games was being made. And he called his social programs the Square Deal. And then his fifth cousin, a couple of decades later, called his arguably the most sweeping social program in American history, the New Deal. So these are poker terms that politicians are master communicators, and they understand what sorts of terminology the citizens of the country relate to at a gut level.
But as you describe it, with Teddy Roosevelt anyway, it was handy language, widely understood language, but it also, in the form of poker, went to something quite essential. He wasn't promising you anything except a square deal, that the cards would be dealt fairly. From then you're on your own.
Right.
This managed to capture a kind of essential American attitude over a long time toward economic interaction.
I think that's yet another reason that Americans have chosen it as their national card game, which is because everyone wants a square deal. So in that sense, we're all equal. But we also want the opportunity to be a little bit more than equal when the game is over.
Let's get a call from Joe in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I love poker. I play it a lot now online. I used to go to casinos. And when I lived in California, poker was legal, where all other forms of gambling were not. They'd have clubs that just have poker, and it's one of the best poker places in the country. But, you know, gambling is, when I see the casinos, the people playing slots, roulette, that's gambling. Scratch tickets, that's gambling. Poker is competition. It's you against the other players. There's no house involved. It's so different that many casinos won't even have poker rooms because they don't make any money on it. They only put it in there to keep the husbands happy while the wives are over pulling slots. And one of the things that makes it great is that, you know, like Tom was saying, you know, I love baseball, But there's no chance of the Sox calling me up and saying, hey, would you come out and help us in the World Series? But in the World Series of Poker, I can play. And, you know, this it's a tremendously fun, exciting way, but it is a individual. It's not a team sport. It's individual. It's you against the other person. I think that's why it's such a male-dominated sport, even though there are some women.
Yep.
But it's a typical male game.
Joe, we got it, and that's great. James McManus, a couple of interesting things. The democratic face of poker, I mean, and you write about it yourself. You know, a relative newcomer can slide right into the World Series, not in baseball, but certainly in poker. But also, you know, this question of whether it's gambling or not. I mean, there have been times in this country's history when we were very tough on gambling. Not so much now, but there certainly have been times.
Well, the Puritan strain in the Congress, in the face of, as represented by Bill Frist and other members of the Bush administration, made quite a aggressive effort when they understood that they couldn't get poker banned, but they attached it to the Safe Ports Act in 2006, and by that means they sneakily made it law that people could play poker online, but they couldn't take money on and off. They attacked the system where the banks worked with the sites in order to receive money and pay out the winners. And Representative Barney Frank has been doing a spectacular job of working to overturn that law and replace it with a law in which you don't ban online gaming, in particular poker, but you tax it. And generating billions of dollars in taxes for the government, as well as regulate the industry to further increase the site's ability to keep children from gambling and from problem gamblers and, of course, cheaters.
But you write about how online poker playing has absolutely exploded. I mean, so there's plenty of it going on. There's plenty of money that moves in that world, and it's changed the face of poker in this country.
Well, poker has been in a gray legal area since the very beginning. You know, as the riverboats wended their way through the Bible Belt, it was not okay to play on land. But if you were on a riverboat, it was considered acceptable. And today we still see that in many states, such as the one I live in, Illinois, you cannot play poker legally on land. But if you're on a boat somewhere, even if they just dig out a moat and puts a building shaped like a boat inside of it, then it's okay to play that. So we're still of two minds about whether poker and gambling in general. Not that poker is a purely gambling game, but it does involve gambling. It's a combination of skill and luck that gets you the money.
Of course, the online world has brought a lot of people to the game that just get shorn kind of upstream by more sophisticated players, is my impression of it.
Well, that's you're about 3 or 4 years out of date with that impression, because the around 2003, when Chris Moneymaker won, he was the first online qualifier to actually win a seat and then go on and win the tournament.
Yeah,
people who played badly and won their places in World Series of Poker events via the internet were called internet players, and was kind of a slur.
Mm.
The irony is that today the best players online, such as Tom Dwan. Routinely beat the best live players from the previous generation. We saw that happening on Poker After Dark. High Stakes Poker. And the internet players are at least as good as the live grizzled veterans.
Keep your big hands up on the table when you're dealing, please. And don't go slipping in them aces down in betwixt your knees. Don't you go making them funny signs like you're trying to tip off your hand. Talking American, boy, American, so that I can understand. Don't you go getting them off the bottom, cause ooh, 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 that's rough. Just take five, then stop, that's enough. Now when you bet, let me see the chips, cause I don't like it when you shy. And if you go broke, go on out and get some more, cause I'm gonna be here by and by. Now just pass them cards for me to shuffle every time before you deal. And then if anything goes wrong, then old Bill's gonna see. I mean, y'all just ain't gonna keep playing this game. Now, according to that fella they call Hoyley, y'all gonna play this game according to me.
Just last week, a big win for a 21-year-old poker player, Joe Catta, who sat down at the World Series of Poker main event, the championship, and won it all. Here's ESPN's promotion playing up the drama.
And then there were two. What an unlikely duo they are. On one side, the logger from Maryland who no one can figure out.
Okay.
My strategy is bet like hell if I have it.
Let's do it again.
Sometimes bet like hell if I don't have it.
Blowing.
On the other, the 21-year-old kid who can't seem to lose.
I got extremely lucky at the final table. I had to say, I'm like almost destined to win.
Each man hoping to defeat the other here on poker's biggest stage.
Oh, boy, pumping it up. The 21-year-old kid who can't seem to lose, who has turned 22 in the week since that big game in his $8.5 million pot, is Joe Catta. He joins us now from Bristol, Connecticut. Joe, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Say hi to James McManus, who's written the history of poker in this country, which you are now part of, sir.
How's it going, James?
Congratulations. You're living the dream. You have the bracelet that everybody wants.
The bracelet that everybody wants. What's it look like, Joe Catta, for those who haven't won it? Have you got it on your wrist right now?
Yeah, actually, I do. I'm over in Bristol, Connecticut, ESPN right now, and got it, and I'm wearing it right now. It's pretty heavy.
It's the champion's bracelet, and you've won it. You won it when you were 21 years old. That's the youngest ever. When and how did you start playing poker? And what did your – I know your mom was a blackjack dealer at Motor City Casino in Detroit, but even so, what did they think when you jumped in hard with poker, Joe?
My mom was pretty skeptical at first about it. You know, she didn't know the difference between actual, like, gambling and, you know, playing cards, that there's a difference. And I started during, like, the whole moneymaker boom like everyone else. You know, that was the thing to do, you know, play cards with friends, you know, just hang out with your friends. And then I started playing online when I was 18.
I read that your parents came around when, shortly thereafter, you bought a house with your winnings.
Yeah, I bought a house when I was 19.
So good for you. But you must know people. You say it's not gambling, but you must know people who have lost plenty too. I mean, you know, gambling is famously, yeah, it can take you on the rocket ride you've been on, but can also really roll over people.
Yeah, I mean, I know people that have lost, and it's one of those things. You know, more people will lose than they win, and it's one of those things that, you know, you just have fun with, and, you know, play really small, and, you know, don't risk anything that you're not comfortable with. You know, it's just supposed to be fun. You know, go just like anything. You know, you go spend money, and have some fun. You know, just play really small, and, you know, if you're good at it, if you have a knack at it, you can keep playing.
But you had small, but you had 50 or 60 million in chips in the game last week. What's your style? What's your strength, Joe? What do you think took you to the top?
Well, I'm a very good shorthanded player, and I mostly play heads up. That's what I play, and I guess I'm a pretty aggressive player for the most part.
Here's the moment when you defeated Darvin Moon to become the youngest World Series Poker main event champion ever.
On day three, Catta jokingly told Peter Riesgate he would break his record. Now he's one card away from doing it. Darvin Moon needs a queen or a jack, or Joe Catta will be the main event champ.
And that's seven. Main event champ ever.
You played a hell of a match. Good in. You played a hell of a match. Seriously, all props on him.
He's a kid with a dream come true. 21 years, 11 months, 21 days old.
Joe Catta winning it all. $8.5 million last week in Las Vegas. He joins us today from Bristol, Connecticut. And Jim McManus, what about this story? How does this fit into the American panorama that you're painting in Cowboys Full?
Well, Joe is typical of the people. Most of the people who play large stakes tournaments, especially at the World Series of main events, are young guys. They tend to be under 30, and they've caught up to what people who've been playing poker for 30 or 40 years know, because there's a variety of books that you can learn the tactics from. And even more importantly, the ability to play large numbers of hands online enables someone who's 17, 18, 19 years old to have played thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of hands. That would take a person who had a drive from town to town across Texas and Oklahoma half a decade to accumulate. So they're smart. They have availability of books. They're high testosterone guys who are willing to gamble. They usually don't have mortgages. They don't have families, and they're just out there to play very aggressively and hope for the best.
Joe Catta, I read that you grew up playing online, and you would play maybe 2,000 hands a day. Is that right?
Yeah, I put in a lot of time in poker, and I used to play like 40, 50 hours a week, and, you know, I typically play on average like around 2,000 hands a day.
Does that make you a different kind of poker player? Because, of course, online you're not watching the other guy or gal's face.
I mean, it's the same game, essentially. I mean, live you're going to have a little more patience because you're seeing less hands, and you can also focus on your players a lot better than rather than playing like 10 tables. So, I mean, I feel like it's a little easier to play live.
You came away from your with the $8.5 million winnings, but just half that pot because somebody staked you for $100,000. That's pretty bold, isn't it? I mean, it's never clear who's going to win in a game like this. Somebody put $100,000 on the table. Who was that? And they took half, right?
Well, I mean, they're very common in the poker world, and, you know, backing is very common in the poker world because the buy-ins are so steep. I mean, I was on a big downswing before the World Series, and the variance is pretty high because the player fields are so large. I mean, if you buy in a tournament like that 20 times, it's $200,000 right there. And my friend was getting backed at the same time by these players, and they back about 60 players in the main event. And, you know, they look at your results, your tournament results, and look at hand histories, and then they go from there whether they want to make the investment or not.
Do these tend to be other poker players, Joe?
Yes, they play poker, but their main source of income is staking people.
Joe Catta won it all last week. $8.5 million was the pot. Laura Lane is with us right now from New York. She's co-host of ESPN's Inside Deal. It's an online-only poker show, contributor to ESPN Magazine. Laura Lane, thanks a lot for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you're always covering this for television. What'd you make of the Joe Catta story last week?
Hi, Joe, by the way, and hi, James.
Hi, Laura.
How are you, Laura?
Good. How are you guys doing? The World Series of Poker was amazing, and it was so great to see somebody like Joe win it. He's so young. He had probably one of the biggest crowds out there at the World Series, and it's really just a spectacle. There's nothing else like it. And it was a great storyline, especially after Peter Eastgate won, to have somebody even younger. I don't think people thought that was going to happen for at least a few years.
ESPN celebrates poker now, along with a lot of other sports. Do you get grief for that, Laura? I mean, after all, as James McManus has pointed out, this country has a long history of, you know, mixed feelings about gambling. This may not be the most straight-up gambling, but it's still a game of chance. Do you get pushback on ESPN for your poker coverage?
ESPN has been so supportive of poker, and you're always going to hear that debate about whether it's a game of skill or a game versus luck, but I think especially in the last year or two, we see the same players consistently being successful, whether it's Peter Eastgate or Daniel Negreanu or especially somebody like Phil Ivey, and a lot of the guys that made it to the final table this year in the World Series of Poker had a ton of success since they made that November 9. Antoine Sayoute made it really far in the World Series of Poker in Europe. So did James Aikenhead and Beglider and Schaffel. A lot of these guys were having a lot of success. So when you see people being consistent, it kind of it's great for the argument that this is really a game of skill when it comes down to it.
James McManus, you've written the book Cowboys Full. If you look back in American history, do you think the big older players what would they have made of this era when, you know, games are televised? Nationally, globally, the whole, you know, lots and lots of people watching on all around the country, would that have been bizarre to them, or would it have fit their sort of understanding that there is a little spectator side to this, and now a lot?
Well, there's a great player by the name of Doyle Brunson who bridges the gap between traveling the road. He was a road gambler from Texas, and they had to not only beat the game, but they had to make sure that the cops didn't bust the game. And once they had to get out of town without the bad guys robbing them. So up until and Doyle Brunson is still extremely active in high stakes poker games, and he is on record saying he could never have imagined the extent to which the game has grown. You know, when he is playing in the first World Series of Poker in 1970, only 7 people sign up. The idea that ESPN would cover it was not even considered a remote possibility, but the game gradually and then very quickly took off. You know, 1983, a satellite winner wins so that you don't have to have $10,000 in cash to compete for the prize. You can play a smaller tournament and win your seat. And then in the 90s, they start televising the game, but in 2003, we started seeing the action with the whole cards exposed. a Holocaust survivor by the name of Henry Ornstein, invents this system whereby cameras shoot up through a glass top and the audience
under the table,
them.
So the TV audience knows what they can't see, what the players cannot see.
The TV audience has more information than the players playing the pot, so it's not only extremely dramatic when somebody's making a huge bet or move with no cards as opposed to playing slowly with a big hand. And then when an online qualifier by the name of Chris Moneymaker wins, then a lot of people say, I could do that because it was no longer theoretical. Somebody with $39 could end up winning $2.5 million as the first prize in the World Championship. Yeah. And as your earlier caller pointed out, the Red Sox are not about to invite him to pitch middle relief in the World Series.
Right.
But anybody who can come up with 10 Gs can compete for poker's World Championship.
Of course, not everybody's going to win. Joe Catta, you've played it a lot in both ways now. Which do you like better, the online version or right there in Vegas with the cameras and all the rest face-to-face in the World Series?
I do enjoy both, and nothing tops the World Series of Poker, of course. I mean, I was so excited to go out there and be able to play in the World Series. I mean, I remember when I was turning 21, everyone was like, oh, are you excited to go to the bars? And I was more excited to, you know, go play in the World Series, and that was what I was looking forward to. And I love playing big live events, and it's fun to travel. Like, I traveled a bunch of other tournaments, and, you know, it's good, you know, seeing the world as you play poker, so I like doing that, but it's also very convenient, you know, waking up and, you know, just opening up your laptop and playing online also.
Wow. Play poker, see the world, and do it all right from bedside if you want to. Joe Catta, congratulations on your big winnings last week. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Laura Lane with ESPN's Inside Deal. Great to have you, Laura. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Dave in Canton, Ohio, you're on the air with James McManus.
Thank you, Tom. Great show as always.
Thank you.
James, your book, Positively Fifth Street, was by far the best book I've ever read. Excuse me. A little nervous. Amazing the way that you wove the story between the murder trial and your experience at the World Series was just phenomenal.
Thanks.
I want to thank you
Thanks
for writing
lot.
That book. I saw you at the final table at another World Series of Poker later after the 2000. Was it 2005 you were at? At that
when I played the hands against Alex Powers?
Yes.
That's the one you're talking about.
What when year I was that?
I believe that was 2004.
Now, how was your experience in that World Series after your experience in 2000? Was it different or because of your experience?
Well, 2000 was the main event in 2000 was the first poker tournament I had ever played in my life. And I played reasonably well, but I also got extremely lucky, as anyone who wins or makes the final table of an event must. Play well, get very lucky. By 2004, I was a much more experienced player, and I had made my second final table, and Alex Powers and I got into an argument about his behavior at the table, and it was an unfortunate event. Alex and I have smoked a peace pipe long ago, and we're totally cool. Yeah. And but at the point that ESPN was editing the tape, instead of leaving the argument on the cutting room floor, they featured it and made it their number two moment of that year's World Series.
And all the world got to see it. Let me get one more call. Dave in Ohio, thanks for calling. David in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and everyone. Just wanted to say I've played poker for about 35 years, but 15 of those years I've played totally blind. In fact, I taught myself Braille with a deck of Braille cards just so I could keep playing poker. And
wow.
I play with seven sighted friends who are too stupid to take my money. and I also have been able, over the 16 years I've been playing, I've only had two down years. So I would have to say skill must be a factor.
And determination, clearly, in your case, David. Thanks for the call, story.
Wow, that's a marvelous story, David.
Right at it, even out of sight. Good luck to you, David. James McManus, what do you take away in the end? The poker mindset, a strength, a weakness, and it's all it's got gambling buried right in the middle of it. You know, it's the an essential American perspective. Does it pay for the country?
I tend to agree with Richard Nixon's college professor at Whittier, Whittier College, who said, a man who cannot hold a hand in a first-class game of poker is not fit to be president of the United States. Whatever we may think of Richard Nixon, his pupil, I do think that the ability to manage money, to have psychological acumen, logic, be good at crunching the kinds of numbers that Bill Gates was crunching at Harvard. Gates insists that he learned more in the dorm room poker games than he did in class, and he learned a lot in class, as he admitted. But that there's so much to learn from playing poker, and it goes hand in hand with the way we've done battle in business for 200 years. And I think it's sort of high time that the rest of the country, whether they want to play poker or not, recognize the gambling, risk-taking, number-crunching acumen that poker players have long displayed.
Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker is the History. James McManus is the author. James, thanks very much for being with us today. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Tom.
We've heard from Robert Johnson and Tex Williams in this hour on the musical front. We've got with Bob Dylan's Rambling Gambling Willie. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You're gambling now, nobody knows. Up in the Rocky Mountains in a town called Cripple Creek, there was an all-night poker game, lasted about a week. 900 miners had laid their money down. When Willie finally left the room, he owned the whole darn town. And it's ride, Willie, ride. Roll, Willie, roll.